place you live in a digital construct of your own making? Sorry, let me ask that another way. If you're trying to decide where to eat, do you walk up and down the street looking around, or is this scene from the TV show Master of None more your speed?
There's so many taco places, we gotta make sure we go to the best one. I'll do some research.
Great. I'll sit here and do nothing.
So Aziz Ansari Googles a bunch of stuff, texts a bunch of people, reads through Yelp reviews and best of lists while consulting a map of the city that is technically right outside his apartment. And this is how he finds his dinner spot, by searching his digital world.
Tacos Morelos?
Sounds good to me.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we're joined now by a KU professor looking into this exact phenomenon, Germaine Halegwa, author of Digital City. Good morning.
Good morning.
Does the scene that we just heard capture something essential in your mind about the way we develop our own sense of place in the 21st century?
Yes, definitely. So I think, like that Master of None scene that we just heard, this is such a common experience. But we don't often think of that experience as digital placemaking or using digital media as a way to create a sense of place for ourselves or others. So I think that it goes beyond restaurant searching, right? I think that we engage digital media to help us navigate space literally, as in wayfinding with GPS, but also to socially navigate space and to dictate or kind of rely on digital media to help us shape our own mobility and the places that we experience as well.
So what is – this is sort of – in opposition to a really popular belief that exists out there that our immersion in our screens is causing us to lose a sense of place and become disconnected from the here and now of the cities we actually live in. You see the opposite happening. Can you explain that?
Yes, absolutely. So I think, as you said, there's this common perception, and I want to call it a misperception, that the more we engage with digital technologies, the less connected we are to the physical environments or the social places in which we find ourselves. So I got a little bit sick of hearing that the more that we use our cell phones on the street, we're disengaging or becoming distracted from the environment in which we're placed within. So what I kind of set out to do was thinking there has to be more to our interactions with digital media than just we're distracted, we're alienated, we're disembedded. And when I looked around at these common practices, like finding a restaurant through Yelp that we just heard on Master of None, or taking a selfie in a location that we really wanted to celebrate our positionality within, or even using GPS on our cell phone to find your favorite restaurant or find this restaurant that Yelp recommended, I saw that as placemaking in a way that was different than alienating. So I have 5 case studies in the book that help me prove that point, that take us through these different ways in which different people in different positions of power actually embrace digital technology to help them create a sense of place for themselves or others.
We will get into that, but if I were going to pick a show, like a scene from a TV show to illustrate the opposite point than the one you are making, I would pick a scene from The Office where Michael is driving and he's got his GPS going. He's got all of his employees in the car and he drives them right into a pond because he refuses to believe his immediate surroundings over and above what his GPS is telling him, which just blatantly contradicts it. This is a pond. You should not keep going.
Yeah. So I think that's also a really common image. And that's one of the images that I find so striking in terms of GPS is that you're so involved in the space behind the screen, or you're so involved in what the digital media is telling you, what this digital technology is telling you, that you're totally disengaged from the reality of the fact that you're driving into a lake or you're driving into a pond. But when
it's extreme, but I will say I have seen people do the thing you were describing before, that being more engaged. I've also seen this thing where, like, anything could be happening while someone's looking at their screen and they would not know it.
I think it depends, right? So what I'm trying to say here is not that everybody always will have this very emplaced experience where they're using digital media or GPS navigation, for example, to pay more attention to the places around them. But I think that if you look at the way that people actually use digital media, which is something that's highly understudied, especially around GPS technologies like Google Maps on your cell phone while driving, that when we look at how people actually use digital technologies, it's a far far more nuanced experience in a lot of cases, not every case. So, for example, when I interviewed or I interviewed a bunch of people, but I also surveyed over 200 people about how they use GPS navigation in their everyday lives. And what they told me was actually they weren't doing what the guy from the office was doing. They were, you know, outsourcing the directions to this apparatus that they saw as working with them to help them get to the places that actually mattered to them. So a lot of people would talk about the fact that, well, I don't want to know the city through turn right, turn left, go straight. I want to know the city through what I see out the window while I'm driving. I want to experience the city through my connections with the person that I'm driving around with. I did a lot of research to find out where this coffee shop that is going to make me feel like I have a sense of belonging in the city is. And I just want to get to that place. And I don't need to really think about how I get there. I want to, in terms of directions, I want to push that aside and really kind of revel and be in the moment of the city that I'm in.
Sense of place is really a buzzword, and people use the phrase typically to reference the feeling you get from a physical place that is so specific to that place that you couldn't be anywhere else. It can come from a smell. It can come from a street name. It can come from the look of a particular kind of architecture. It can come from a memory that is connected to a spot. The idea of creating a sense of place through a technology that is very detached from the physical might feel like a contradiction to a lot of people.
Yeah, it seems paradoxical at first, right? Why would we turn to machines to help us feel more human, right? But I think what is common about all of those things that you described is that sense of place then becomes this way of producing an emotional or psychological attachment to a physical location or to, a physical location of any sort, really. And so what I think we're doing when we turn to digital media to help us get more human or a more humanized experience of this sense of place that is emotional, that is psychological, is that we're making place. We're working with technologies to build place or to call it into being in a way that's maybe personalized or familiar, but that creates this sort of sense of temporary permanence or this sense of belonging within these kind of worlds that seem so in flux.
Your book is called Digital City, so let's start by defining what a city is. How do you define that word just on its own?
That is a really interesting question. So getting down to the basics, I mean, I think that instead of describing a city as a geographical location or a specific type of urban form, which it is, I think of the city as this kind of amalgam of social relations. So it's a city, it's a location that is dense by definition, usually, but it's where a lot of different people come together, and through their interactions, through their social interactions within this dense physical environment, it creates all of these different meanings of the space that then intermingle with one another. But also the city also becomes this space in which you see carved into its construction all of these different relations of power that get inscribed in the size of the sidewalks, in the size of the streets, in how many traffic lights are in a certain neighborhood, how many grocery stores are there or not. So I think when I think of the city, I think of it as these inscriptions of social relations and power relations that play out in the physical environment.
You reference Italo Calvino's Invisible Cities, which happens to be one of my all-time favorite books. And it's a book that imagines Marco Polo describing fantasy cities to Kublai Khan, who grows increasingly suspicious that Marco Polo is just making stuff up, which he both is and isn't. I brought my tattered copy to discuss it. You compare the new cities being physically built to be what is called a smart from the start city to the invisible city of Esmeralda. So first, I want you to explain what a smart from the start city is, and then I want you to talk about Esmeralda.
Okay, so a smart from the start city is a city that's built from scratch, and it's built from scratch with digital technologies in mind. So sometimes in these cities that are built from the ground up, and this is happening mostly in East Asia, it's happening in There's a really famous one in Saudi Arabia right now. There were plans for one in Portugal. There's over claimed to be over 100 trying to be built in India. So
it's definitely if you build it, they will come as a mentality. Like there, this isn't a city now, but we're building it and we're building it this way.
Yes, exactly. And so this way, the way that you just mentioned, is with digital computing opportunities built into the woodwork everywhere. So some of these cities are referred to ubiquitous computing fortresses, right? So they're supposed to be a hub for trade, usually. They're supposed to attract capital. They're supposed to attract people to come live there, usually transnational elites. But also they are selling themselves as a specific place because they are wrought with computing opportunities, because they are this sort of high-tech space in which everything is connected.
And that will create the sense of place, the prevalence of computing opportunities.
Exactly. And in a lot of these cases, that's the only thing that creates the sense of place. There's often buildings that look like skyscrapers that are anywhere. They're very, you go to a space like Songdo, which is a place that I've been to several times in South Korea, and it doesn't look particularly unique in the sense that it looks very different than a non-smart city, right? Or a city that isn't built from scratch. But what is being sold or how it's being branded is that it is a ubiquitous computing. There are ubiquitous computing fortresses everywhere. So the way that I was linking it to Esmeralda or linking it to Italo Covino's work is mostly about the social imagination. So like you said, the character is believed and not believed. You're not quite sure. So I was bringing up this idea, not so much that these cities are Esmeralda, but that the people in Italo Covino's book had a really kind of weird relationship with the city of Esmeralda, that it was a little bit, there was a lot of friction there. And I think
describe how people live in Esmeralda.
And actually, I think that it's not so much that I wanted to directly compare them to Esmeralda because, and I don't really want to get into it too much because I don't want to celebrate this idea. It wasn't my idea. It was how it was being branded by the company that was building the cities that I was looking at.
The idea there, though, is that there are infinite paths to get any place.
Yes. So that idea, I mean, we could say that I think that the reason why the company that was invested in building the city was calling upon this image of Esmeralda is because they were trying to, I think, do two things. One, in terms of the paths to get everywhere, sell these cities as incredibly walkable. So one of the things that also happens with a lot of these smart from the start cities is that they're sold as green cities or eco cities. So this idea of walkability of paths, but also because the city is built from scratch without any people living in this space.
Without any history. Just a total blank slate of a city.
Yeah. So they're pulling from a variety of different iconic urban environments, urban buildings, sense of place that have been cultivated in other cities that are celebrated on the global market. And they're bringing this together to say, hey, this is a place you want to be. So I think the allusions to Esmeralda are to say, well, hey, you're not going to get bored here. So to counteract some of that artificiality, to counteract some of that, well, what do I do there? Where do I go? Call upon this place as particularly walkable, but also a reference to the many paths that the digital media might take you in.
You know, it occurred to me while reading this section of your book that part of what gives us a sense of place has always been invisible. It has been the narrative, like a narrative thread that we have connecting us to either the past or other people. And the idea of a city built from scratch just totally lacks those threads, which are also not about the here and now. But in Kansas City, for example, you know, people are obsessed with learning the history of our city. And that's part of because we feel ourselves as part of an ongoing story. It is so weird to me to imagine going to a place that has none of that.
Yeah. And I think that the techniques for making place in that particular instance where there isn't an organic history to rely on. And in a lot of these cases, some of the pre-existing population were pushed out or bought out of where they were living. And new sand was brought out from the ocean and dumped on this place. So a lot of the any pre-existing history that might have been there is also erased. So I think that one of the things that intrigued me about these Smart From the Start cities is that, well, how do you make place without people? How do you make place without history? Even though it's always been invisible, it's always been imaginative in some way. You're trying to build both that social imagination of the city and the urban form of the city from scratch together at the same time. How does that work?
It is very dangerous to inspire me to pick up invisible cities because once I start, I can't stop. And so I did stumble upon what I would consider to maybe be the opposite of a Smart From the Start city. It's a city called Marilia. Fictional city and from a book, but I'm going to read part of that description. In Marilia, the traveler is invited to visit the city and at the same time to examine the old postcards that show it as it used to be. A hen in the place of a bus station, a bandstand in the place of the overpass, two ladies with white parasols in the place of a munitions factory. If the traveler does not wish to disappoint the inhabitants, he must praise the postcard city and prefer it to the present one. And it seems like the dangers of not having enough of a sense of place because you're so immersed in your technology have been described at length. People worry about it a lot. There is this opposite danger of being so attached to history that you can't let go.
That's an interesting way to think about it. So I think that a lot of what we do with our digital media is not one or the other. It's not about erasing history and living completely in the present. It's not about, kind of erasing our past. In a lot of cases, and this is one of the chapters in the book, I talk a little bit about these early locative media projects, these projects that were cell phone-based or web-based that allowed you to photograph the city or photograph places in the city that were meaningful to you. And one of the things that people tended to do with these digital media projects was they talked about the history, they talked about the past, but from a very personal perspective. So what you ended up getting were people posting these pictures of Coney Island as it used to be, or empty lots in the middle of New York City that were now skyscrapers and saying, you know, this is where I used to play as a child, or I remember that YMCA pool and now the building has been torn down. So you get this interesting, I think what digital media technologies allow us to do is also layer these temporalities, right? Layer history with the present and be looking at a photograph of a bodega and saying, hey, that used to be my childhood home.
If you have a question about digital placemaking for KU Media Studies Professor Germaine Halegwa, author of The Digital City, call 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCURCST. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. And when we get back, we'll hear about Kansas City as a case study. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Germaine Halegwa, a film and media studies professor who's written a book about how we use digital media and smartphones to create our experiences of the actual cities we live our lives in and help us, quote, re-embed ourselves within the urban space. Did I explain that okay?
I like that. That sounds great.
So some of your research actually comes from Kansas City. We are one of the case studies because of Google's Fiber for Communities thing. Remind listeners who weren't here when all of that got started what that was all about.
Sure. So I moved to the Kansas City area. I live in Lawrence, but I moved here in 2011. And that coincided with the year that KCK and KCMO, so Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri, were selected after this year-long bid for Google to build a 1 gigabit high-speed fiber optic network cable digital connectivity in their city. So Kansas City, Kansas, Kansas City, Missouri won and in 2011. And then in 2012, Google had this participatory model for having neighborhoods sign up to pre-register to get Google Fiber in their
It was like a contest, if I remember right.
Exactly. So there were two layers of contest. One, there was a contest to be the city that was chosen. And then there was, it was sort of a contest in which you tried to rally your neighborhood and members of your neighborhood to pay this $10 pre-registration fee to get enough critical mass to then make you a fiberhood, make you a neighborhood that was eligible to receive service. So this was before even subscribing. You had to kind of participate in this contest, maybe sort of way, to get Google Fiber to claim you as one of the communities that would get their service.
What caught your interest about this?
So I was first really interested in that model. Well, what happens when you kind of rely on other neighbors or other community members to do something that you want for your own private household? But I was also curious. So I was curious how this was going to pan out. But what happened also around 2012 was after the first round of signups came in, what we saw were these maps that Google was putting out to notify people about whether their neighborhood qualified or didn't qualify. But the maps of Kansas City were striking to me. And I had just recently moved here, but I had heard of the Troost Wall. And I don't know if everybody calls it that, but some of the participants in the study that I talked to refer to it as the Troost Wall, which is along Troost Avenue. There's always been this historical sort of racial economic dividing line between East and West. So what we saw in the Google Fiber maps when they first came out after that participatory kind of experiment and implementation of the fiber network, we saw that the places that didn't sign up, the neighborhoods that didn't qualify for Google Fiber, were the same neighborhoods that never had at-home robust internet connection, that were on the, quote, wrong side of the digital divide, but also were historically less privileged than the side of Kansas City that did sign up. And that intrigued me, was this layering of inequity on top of each other in a way that I guess wasn't expected.
That past inequity was going to dictate future inequity.
Exactly.
That a process of connecting people digitally sent you back to a new understanding of a map of a physical place seems really tied to what you're trying to say about digital placemaking.
Exactly. So I think that example, what we see in that example of Kansas City is a lot of things. But one is that tension that placemaking is bottom up and top down. And I think that goes to it's to say that that's the way it is before digital media, but I think that
when you say bottom up versus top down, I just want to clarify. You mean that we make our own places for ourselves to some degree, but then like power structures kind of dictate what our sense of place is in other ways. So like if I'm not going to create my bus route, someone else is going to create my bus route.
Exactly. I think that's a really good example. So that we're constantly interfacing with these sort of place being something that municipal officials and urban planners and urban managers, city managers make, but also that community members and neighbors make as well. And when we look at the case of Google Fiber, we see that digital media also kind of are both top down and bottom up. And when the two imaginations of what digital connectivity can do and different ideas about implementation models come together, we do see frictions, we do see tensions that come out that do overlay themselves with pre-existing inequities that we talked about before.
I put out a call for our listeners to ask questions or share stories about digital placemaking. And Leslie from Mission Hills has an interesting piece of history to share. Leslie, welcome to the show.
Well, good morning, Gina. This is so fascinating, and I'm not sure how to wrap this all in, but there is a community outside of Washington, D.C., that was built conceived of in the 60s, early 60s, and built throughout the 70s, called Reston. And it was this idea of creating place. Of course, this is pre-digital, right? Mm-hmm. And it's become a very robust and sought-after neighborhood with all the complexities that humans bring to those endeavors of living in closer space. But I was saying to the producer, one of the things so interesting to me now is that people there, the most coveted spaces, of course, are the oldest spaces, the coolest mid-century madman, you know, type buildings. And but it was centered on place very much. And I don't know that they talked about the dimensions of, the width of the paths, or the sidewalks, but there are walking paths and nature trails and connecting of nature to the space and so on. Obviously today the connectivity issue is how well does it link into the VRE to get you to downtown Washington or to some of the, beltway, commuting hubs. So, I just wanted to put that out there because it, studying it and reading about Robert Simon, you would sort of hear a lot of what you're talking about without the overlay of the fiber networks, fiberhoods, as you were calling them. And I lived through that Google fiasco. That's a fascinating thing. Also, being a transplant to Kansas City, it's something that I think we have the history then that's brought forward that overlays as you try to do something maybe a little different like Google tried to do. And there's another book to be aware of and work of a man named Stilgo, I believe, John Stilgo. It's called Outside Lies Magic. And it's about just observation of ordinary things in places, like why do trunk lines run the way they do in electrical lines, or fire hydrants lay out the way they do on roads, or, you know, beside electrical grids, the malls and the main streets. And it helps you to approach new places that you travel to and observe, you know, historically. So if you're deep in old Europe or in parts of burgeoning, growing, developing countries, and how that context is laid in.
Thank you, Leslie.
So now I suppose.
Thank you so.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to pick up on a couple of things Leslie said. One of them is she conjured this image of like electric lines running sort of at a certain angle to a tree. When I think about something like that, there might be an image of just an ordinary scene from a city like that, or, you know, like birds on the wire, whatever, that makes you feel very like, oh, this is this exact spot. The idea that that just happened and that you just stumbled upon it has never been true. That didn't just coincidentally happen, that power lines run where they do, and that that I happened to be walking on the path where I was. City planners and electrical companies and a lot of other people like made that moment in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. I really liked that comment from Leslie, actually, for a lot of different reasons. I mean, one, I love what you're saying, Gina, that a lot of the things that we think are just happenstance or, oh, that was a coincidence, are actually,
if I would just walk outside and experience it, you know.
Exactly. Or it comes into being when I see it, right? But I think that it's important to remember that a lot of these things are planned by people, right? That people are making place, but also that people are constructing things that then give us a very personalized feeling or personalized experience of
and
place.
And just like people make our smartphones.
Yes, exactly. And I think that one thing that came out of Leslie's comment and your comment as well is that a lot of these things that we think are new, as in digital media overlaying connectivity and changing the way that we experience place, are actually just maybe another iteration of things that we've experienced for years, right? She mentioned Reston as a planned community that I don't know the exact history of Reston. I don't want to make claims about it, but we have seen cities built from scratch over time. Brasilia is an excellent example, not really a very positive example. It's often
like Levittowns.
Levittown, exactly. But this is maybe the smart from the start cities are another maybe evolution of that or another iteration of that. But I also like that allusion to the electrical lines or to the bus networks or to other sort of forms of mobility, because I think often we see digital connectivity laid on top of those pre-existing networks and complicating those pre-existing networks in the way that we saw with the Kansas City example, exacerbating previous inequities or adding another layer of meaning to those connections.
You know, when you talk about your Kansas City research, I wonder if you can share a little bit more from your process of interviewing people and surveying people about their experience of connectivity in Kansas City, digital or otherwise.
Yeah. So the way that I went about it in the Kansas City example, and each chapter I do sort of slightly different methodology, but the way that I went about it in the Kansas City example is mainly through participant observation. So I would go into Kansas City and I went to a number of digital literacy classes. So Connecting for Good, I visited the W.E.B. Du Bois Center, I went to a bunch of digital inclusion Coalition and KC Digital Drive events. I went to happy hours about Google Fiber. And at these events, I would talk to people who were in attendance and say, you know, hey, have you signed up for Google Fiber? Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship to this project? And even though I was at Google Fiber events in some of these cases, some of the people that were debating whether to sign up or not had really interesting processes of assessing whether this network was for them. So I also ended up talking to
Can you describe some of those?
Sure. Yeah. So I would talk to people about, well, hey, you know, I had a couple of people mention, you know, I live in an apartment building and my landlord isn't signing up for this. At first, apartment buildings had a really tenuous relationship with Google Fiber based on their policy. You couldn't sign up for this service unless you were a single, like, family home, right? So that it was basically privileging a direct connection to a household, which was a building, right? Which wasn't an apartment building, which was a standalone sort of house.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were like, hey, I'm a renter. I don't want to pay this money, even though it's affordable potentially within my price range for some people. I don't want to invest in my household like this because I know I'm going to move a couple times within the year, or I'm going to move next year. So this isn't for me. So one of the things that kept coming up in my conversations at all of these different events and all of these different organizations was people saying, for a variety of different reasons, well, I'm not going to sign up because this isn't for me. And when they said that to me, especially people who had never had internet connection at home, people maybe of lower income or less privileged backgrounds, minority and marginalized populations, people of color, they were saying this isn't for me. Look around and you can see what I mean. And so I started looking around and I was looking at marketing materials and I was looking at the policy, Google Fiber policy, about one connection per household, not sharing signals. And I was looking at the way, or listening to the way, that people were constructing their own understanding of home and mobility and connectivity.
And sense of belonging in this digital version of Kansas City.
Exactly. And there wasn't necessarily a sense of belonging for all populations. So it speaks to this idea that maybe terms like community, this project was called Fiber for Communities, or neighborhood, really are ambiguous enough that they can be used for different purposes and that they take on different meanings for different populations, and that some of these corporations might miss that in their planning.
Germaine Halegwa, author of The Digital City, thank you so, so much for being here today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Up next, the story of a cemetery in Weston and a new monument that just went up there on Martin Luther King Day. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now we're going to hear the story of a historic cemetery, one of the first integrated cemeteries in Missouri, Laurel Hill Cemetery in Weston. A new monument's gone up with the names of people buried there in unmarked graves, people of color, both free and slave, who didn't get that acknowledgement when they were buried. My guests are going to tell that story now. Carla Sutton, good morning.
Good morning.
And Jess Larson, hello to you too.
Hi.
We'll be hearing shortly from someone with family buried in this cemetery, but I want to get to the story first of how this all came about. What is the history of Laurel Hill? I'll start with you, Jess.
Well, as you said, it was one of the first integrated cemeteries in the state. People from out of town, from Platte County, would, especially people of color, would be buried there, sometimes in the middle of the night, sometimes, you know, days later, sometimes without any kind of obituary at all.
Why under those circumstances? Can you explain that?
I suppose mostly it had to do with the era that it was and the fact that the people were black.
And that you maybe still had to be kind of not out in daylight doing this, maybe.
Right. There was still a lot of issue over mixing blacks and whites together.
And Carla, I want to hear from you a little bit more about the monument that just went up and what it has done, what it's seeking to do.
It is seeking to give recognition to those who have laid there in the cemetery for years without any acknowledgement of their burial there, no marker, no grave marker.
You were really involved in raising money for this monument. Can you take me back to the beginning of your interest in kind of attempting to right this historic wrong?
Well, how it started was one day I was invited up to the Weston Historical Museum to be a docent for the afternoon as a volunteer, and I was looking around the room, and I came upon this magnificent display of African American people that used to live in Weston. Weston used to be 45% African American. It was an amazing display, and I came up on a card that read, there were over 400 souls buried in Laurel Hill Cemetery with no marker.
Jess, you were very involved in gathering names that belonged on the monument. How did you do that?
Actually, that was more my mother. She wrote a book called We Two Lived, and she used old newspaper microfilms to find obituaries and news articles to identify those people buried up there.
What do you think for the, it's really a huge leap of my imagination to go from unmarked graves to a list of names that can be erected on a monument. The backtracking, it's sort of like a detective work.
Yes. It took her almost a whole decade to identify all those people that she did find names for.
So what happened on Martin Luther King Day, Carla?
We had a dedication of the new monument on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. There were about 50 people standing in 12-degree weather.
It was snowing.
Snow lightly falling. And we had about a half-hour program devoted to the dedication, and we pulled off the cover of it and so that everyone could see the beautiful stone underneath. And then we had the playing of taps to end the ceremony.
Angela Hagenbach is with us now. She is a famous Kansas City jazz singer. You may know her name because of that. She has an ancestor buried in Laurel Hill Cemetery, and we're going to hear about that now. Hi, Angela.
Hi.
How did you come to realize this history pertained directly to you and your family?
Well, I found out in about 1998 that my mother's people came to Missouri by way of Weston. And you know, I was busy with my career and things, but when I found time, I would do more and more research. And I have more than an ancestor buried there. I have lots.
Lots of ancestors.
Lots, yes. And so, but I found this out probably 20 years ago. There's a headstone there that it's David Vaughn, is one of my great-great-great-grandfathers. Great-great-great, yeah. And his entire family shares this one headstone, and the names are engraved on both sides, but it's deteriorated. But when I first discovered it, I could read it better than I can now. And then Dinah Robinson, she's the one that her name made it on the monument, and she was very active in the community, and both before her emancipation, she, by the way, got emancipated in 59, before
1859,
exactly.
This is
before the Civil War.
How much of this research, how much of your knowledge of these ancestors came to you through your own research, and how much had been passed down to you?
Well, my mother passed in 88, and she never mentioned her folks came to Missouri by way of Weston, and I never thought to ask because, you know, I just
sometimes
didn't.
The curiosity doesn't come till later.
Right, right. So, but I've found out a lot of information by research and archival materials in Platte City at their records office and such, and then about 4 years ago, maybe three, I stumbled across We Two Lived.
The book that Jess's mom
yes.
wrote.
And so that added a lot of the puzzle pieces that I couldn't find, because they were basically snippets of newspaper articles or information from Saxton's listings and that type of thing. And I didn't even know about Dinah Robinson until about 10 years ago when I found a will from her daughter. And that's how I found out that was my great-great-great-grandmother. I knew her daughter's name. And so, but I tell you, it's just shocking how many of my people are there. And so there are 400 names, but there's a lot more that, you know, that didn't get recorded at all.
Yeah, so as you sort of came to realize that you had a lot of ancestors buried in this cemetery, and that many of them, the vast majority of them, were in unmarked, unnamed graves. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that felt like to you?
Well, it makes me very sad, and I feel really bad. But that happened all over this, you know, the South.
You weren't maybe shocked.
I wasn't shocked. No, I was pleased to have it elevated and have it brought out in the open. Very much pleased, and you know, of course, some of the sadness went away because of the. You know, of your good work, Carla. I almost called you Carla Sutton. Well, that is your name. But because of that, you know, it was highlighted, and people now know, and other ancestors of these people. And like Jess said, it wasn't just the Black population of Weston. It was the population from surrounding areas. And it was a segregated cemetery, but they accepted other Black people from around the area, which is also, you know, very nice. And my take on why it happened at night and undercover, because first of all, they had to wait until the workday was done, and you know, sun up. I mean, can't see, you know, essentially. And then they had to get there and bring their dead and do their ceremonies at night. But the fact that they had a place to do it, you know, is very nice. And so we'll never really know unless we, you know, have one of those aerial views of seeing how many bodies are everywhere. But we'll never know how many are there. But the fact that we have brought it to the attention, to the forefront, and we are getting more and more attention on this fact is wonderful. And it's long, long, long overdue. And
has it felt more like a paying of respect since the names went up?
Yeah, of course. You know, they were viable human beings. They had multi-generational lives there. They lived there. They worked there. They had their families there. They, you know, for good or for bad, it's nice to have a place that I can go, which is, I live in Parkville, so I'm about 25 minutes away. And I can commune there with them and continue to learn about and reconstruct their lives through my research and through the book that Jess's mom wrote. It's been extremely helpful.
Will you tell me a little more about the experience of reading that book? Would you mind telling me more of the experience of reading Jess's mom's book? And what specifically you learned through that book that turned on all these light bulbs for you?
Well, when I first came across the book, I was having lunch with my sister, Joyce, and we were up in Weston trying to trace some of our roots. You know, as I said, we've been working on this for a number of years. And this woman at Pastimes is where I was having lunch. She says, well, here's a book that might be of interest to you. And she flipped it open. It was her book, so I couldn't take it or borrow it, you know. Anyway, so it flipped open right to a page where it says, there were my great-grandparents' wedding. It's
your great-grandparents'
yes,
wedding.
By name. And, you know, you never see, you know, unless they're, you know, famous Black people.
Oh my gosh, I need to say, you've pulled out your copy of the book and you have all the pages marked with colored tabs. And this is clearly highlighting, this is a much used, much loved resource for you.
Exactly. It's a Bible. But it's very short. May I read it?
Yes, please.
Okay. It says, August 26, 1904, Dillard Foster and Ida Mariah Dayton, both colored of this city, were married Wednesday evening. And it's just snippets like that all throughout the book of the Black population, or the colored, as they were called back then. And just little things like that. And I learned a lot about one of my ancestors, Sonny Vaughn. He was a political activist and a community organizer. And he got out one of his missions was to get out the vote for the colored folks, as the book says. And he ran for office, and he loved to, you know, do community activities and have picnics and grill. You know, he loved to grill and cook, you know, and those are the things that, you know, my my family, we love to do that, you know, grill and have people gathering and eating and drinking. And so it really humanizes them. You know, they're not.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of my job, as far as I'm concerned, with my ancestors is to put some meat on the bones, you know, and tell their stories, because they built Weston, basically.
Yeah, and a name is part of putting meat on their bones.
Exactly.
You know, I'm curious about all of your take on this. What is the larger story of cemeteries and how they reflect the divisions and hardships, but also like milestones of progress that people experienced in life? You know, Jess, this story of We Two Lived, that's not about death, but it is so pertinent to this cemetery and the stories that it tells.
Yes. One of the most amazing parts of that book, as Angela said, is that it doesn't just tell you when they died. It gives you snippets of their life and helps build that connection with the past that has previously been lost.
Particularly anything that happened between 1980 and 1900, because there was no 1880 and 1900, because there was no 1990 census. So everything that happened in that 20-year span is a boon, because I would have never have known that they were still there, because there was no census for 20 years. And people die and get married and do lots of things in 20 years. So.
I want to talk to Joyce, who is calling us from Kansas City. Joyce, what is the story you want to share with us?
I, too, am a descendant of Western Missouri, and I'm about ready to cry.
Hi, Joyce.
Hi there. My folks were David Boyd.
Okay.
And Ida Boyd.
Okay.
She's looking through her book. Joyce, talk to me about what this means to you that these...
So much. I've been wanting to do this for years, but I didn't know how. And one of the houses is also a Mayor Bethune school.
Right.
Yes.
When you say you've been wanting to do this for years, but you didn't know how, you mean get names in that cemetery?
Yes, and get a plaque of everything, yes.
Well, can you tell us a little bit more about the personal connection you have?
My mother was born there. My aunt was born there. My sister went to school there for a while. Yes, a lot of connections, a lot of unhappiness up there.
A lot of unhappiness, but...
That's why so many left.
Yeah.
It was part of the Great Migration.
And the desire to see something remain that says, like, they were here. Here walked.
Yes. Yes.
Well, Joyce, thank you for that call. I assume, Carla, that you are hearing a lot of outpourings of emotion like this.
Yes. Yes, I am. And it's very gratifying to know how deeply moved these people are by what has happened in Weston.
I want to hear a little bit more before we go about the dedication ceremony, because as you mentioned, it was Martin Luther King Day. This plaque was unveiled, and about 50 people, you say, showed up in the snow to stand outside and witness this moment. If you could tell us a little bit more about the stories behind that, I would be so grateful.
Well, we opened with a prayer by the president, the pastor of our church, the Western United Methodist Church, welcomed by the president of the cemetery board, Paul Norman. And
I guess I mean the stories that people brought, the stories that brought people to witness this moment.
The stories that brought people to witness. I didn't really hear a lot of their stories. I think Angela has heard more than I.
But when Bill and Carla started raising funds for this, would you say it took a month? I mean, once the word got out that this is, you know, this is a travesty, what can we do about it? And
yes, people opened up their pocketbooks and wanted to give. It took a little over a month to get all of the donations for the $9,000 that the monument was going to cost. And the monument was designed and built by the Byrd Memorial up in Atchison.
And it's beautiful. I encourage everyone to come and see it. It's in Weston on Welt and Mulberry Street.
Well, our time is up, but Angela Hagenbach, thank you so much for sharing your family's story today and your own story.
You're welcome.
And Jess Larson and Carla Sutton, thank you for talking to us about Laurel Hill Cemetery and the monument that's just gone up there naming people of color buried in unmarked graves for a long time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gina.
That's a wrap. You can get any of the Central Standard interviews you might have missed or just want to share at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. It's where we keep all our past shows. Tomorrow is a food show, and we will give our critics a chance to pay tribute to Charles Ferruza, who was an anchor of our food shows for so long. It'll be Valentine's Day, and in honor of Charles's less than fond memories of waiting tables on that holiday, we will offer a search for the best restaurants in Kansas City for dining alone. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date.